Juries are used in a significant share of criminal and non-criminal cases in our country. Perhaps you've served on a jury. What was that experience like? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, with the backdrop of the high-profile George Zimmerman murder trial, we look at the role of juries, their origins, we learn how juries have evolved, and also examine the recent flourish of media attention aimed at the jurors who sat for the Zimmerman trial. My guests, Professors John Allen and John Whiston of the University of Iowa College of Law, also attorney Sharon Greer of Marshalltown. Why we have juries and how well they work after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Juries are used in a significant share of criminal and non-criminal cases in our country. Perhaps you have served on a jury or several times served on a jury. What was that experience like? We're going to be talking about the role of juries in our judicial system, in our justice system this hour. Also with the backdrop of that high-profile George Zimmerman murder trial, we'll look at the role of juries, their origins. We'll learn how they evolved. And then later in the hour, we'll talk about the Trayvon Martin case and the role that the jury played there. Joining us this hour to discuss the American jury system, John Whiston is with us, the Herschel G. Langdon Clinical Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Professor Whiston, John, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
John Allen is with us as well in our Iowa City studio, clinical professor and Bowden Fellow in Trial Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. John Allen, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And joining us by phone, Sharon Greer is a litigator for Cartwright, Drucker, and Ryden in Marshalltown, Iowa. Sharon, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
John Whiston, let's start off with you since you have the expertise that can tell us where all this came from. Start us off by telling us, where did the idea of juries come from?
Once upon a time, long, long ago, I was a medieval history major, mm-hmm. and sometimes I worry that all my lectures at the law school begin with once upon a time in the 12th century. But this applies here. Once upon a time in the 12th century, King Henry II of England, that you may remember from Becket and The Lion in Winter, established an ordinance saying that 12 men, good and true, in each county had to go out and figure out who was violating the law. And so the very first law that we have looked a lot like what we now call the grand jury, that these minor noblemen were supposed to go out and find out who was violating the law.
So not only sit on a jury, but actually go out into the community and be almost enforcers, too.
And that was what it's called. These early forms of the jury were called self-informing. And so one of the noblemen would say, I think Garth the swineherd is stealing horses. And he would say, I know him. He's a liar and a cheat. And the other person on the jury would say, oh, no, I saw that horse at the market on Thursday. And they would make a decision about whether to charge Garth with stealing horses. The funny thing about this, odd thing about this, is that the trial actually at this point was a trial by ordeal, something like Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail, where they would throw the person in the pond, and if they sank, they were guilty. But the church very quickly said, no, we don't want to do anything about that. So they developed this system of grand juries, mm-hmm. large juries that did the charges, and then they had petty or petite juries that actually tried the case, and they would go out and be self-informing. And so all of these people for the first 200-300 years knew the defendant, knew the people that were involved in the lawsuit, and had some information. They were both the witnesses and the finders of fact.
Mm-hmm. And were they paid by the authorities?
No, it was all volunteer. It was all oftentimes involuntary. You're on the jury. And then by the 16, 1700s, with the development of society, which the individual personal relationships between people started fraying because society was bigger and more complicated, they started having juries that we would recognize now, where people would come in that weren't self-informing, that didn't know the people, and then you had lawyers that were developed and rules of evidence that were developed, and those people ultimately found the person guilty or not guilty.
What was the turning point that turned jurors from self-informing to basically ignorant of a case when they entered and sat on a jury?
There's no individual spot that I could identify. It was just a process over about 300 years. Mm-hmm. So by the time we get the jury showing up in America, we find it looking quite like what we see today. It was a central part of English men's rights. So there was a Bill of Rights from the 1680s that said that the trial by jury was a crucial English right. And so in the early part of our history, in the colonial time period, the English people here thought that a trial by jury was a central fundamental right. And when King George started infringing on that, it was part of the impetus for the American Revolution. It appears in the Declaration of Independence.
And King George infringed on that because when you are judged by a jury of your peers and all your peers are patriots, you tend to make a judgment that is perhaps not to the liking of King George.
Oh, exactly. There was a lot of jury nullification, which we might get to in that period.
Okay. So the idea of juries, how widespread is that in the in the world?
We're about the only tradition that does it. It's really well rooted in the English experience. Mm-hmm. And so the Anglo-Saxons and the Danes and the Norwegians all had some tradition of this way back into the distant past, and the Welsh. But the rest of the world, they look upon this as kind of a foreign practice. Their practices are more formed by Roman law and church law and the Napoleonic Code. So normally in most European courts, the decision is made by just a judge. And just in the last 50 years, like Germany now has a very small jury where they will have a professional judge or two and a lay judge or two. So it looks a little bit like a jury, but nothing like what we would see.
How did juries evolve in terms of who can be a juror? Speaking in terms of our country, we started off with voters who were only landowners, were only white males.
Exactly.
Was it the same with the jurors?
Exactly. There was always a connection between the franchise being able to vote and who could serve on juries. And so when the franchise, who could vote, started to change, then who served on a jury started to change. So I'm originally from Wyoming, the equality state. And it's the equality state because it was the first jurisdiction in the United States to allow women to vote in 1868. And so in 1870, they allowed women to sit on juries. And then 2 years later, the Chief Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court said, no, this is a terrible idea. And women did not serve on juries in Wyoming for another 70 years until the 1940s, until my mom was able to sit on a jury.
John Whiston is the Herschel G. Langdon Clinical Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. If you'd like to join our conversation, especially if you've served on a jury, what stood out for you about that experience? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. If you've served on a jury, tell us what stood out for you about that experience. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. John Allen, also with the University of Iowa College of Law, give us your take on the rationale behind juries who are up to the point they enter the trial relatively or completely uninformed about a case, and juxtapose with what your colleague John Whiston just said, having a, what would we say, self-informed jury.
Part of it is to start with our constitutional roots here, so that with the Sixth Amendment and a criminal trial, you have a right to a jury by a fair, or to a fair and impartial jury. The sort of ignorance that we spend so much time rooting out is really aimed at ensuring the impartiality of the jurors who are about to sit. It seems to me that one of the sort of interesting aspects of law that people have a hard time dealing with is the indeterminacy that is in the law. That the law, we can describe it, and yet the application to an individual circumstance is really complex. And each case presents unique facts. And so one of the questions that you have to ask is, as we sort of try to make determinations in this indeterminate world, where should that power reside? And we've chosen to have that power reside in the people, literally this group of 12 or how many ever it happens to be, people who are drawn together to make that decision in that sort of indeterminate place. And it's an interesting place. Obviously, you have the advantage of avoiding external powerful influences when you attenuate that power across a group of people. But it also, I think, reflects our national democratic values, that those sorts of decisions ultimately reside with the people. That power resides with the people.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the selection process, because people can be called to jury duty but actually never serve on a jury. Take us through that process and what is meant to happen and what does happen.
Well, I mean, the first sort of selection point is who goes on the jury list, right? So we, by statute in Iowa, and most states are similar to this, will have registered voters, licensed drivers, and maybe state ID holders. So you create this sort of list from which the grand pool, as it were, at in our state at the county level. Then those – a certain number of names called the veneer, this group of people that will come to look at a particular case or potentially consider a particular case is drawn from that grand pool. And then if you've been there, they have various forms. They used to do it with like a tumbler, like a – it looked like a lottery game or something. You'd pull names out of this tumbler. And now it's typically randomized by computer and names are selected. There's X number of jurors that sit. And then we the process begins initially by trying to sort out whether or not there are any what they call challenges for cause, people who for whatever reason are not considered to be fair and impartial jurors, who come typically with strong opinions about the particular case or the category of case.
And that's determined through questions, through oral questions, or beforehand with a questionnaire?
Well, some of it can be determined by questionnaire. So, for example, there's limits on the degrees of consanguinity that might exist. So we have a 4 degrees of consanguinity rule.
What is consanguinity?
I don't know. we're talking about people who are related by blood or otherwise. To one of the parties in the case. Now that that seems sort of obvious. If you're a felon, for example, you are not qualified to sit on a jury. So there are some of those that can be sorted out without reference to the questioning. But eventually, the majority of challenges for cause are done through questioning of the jurors, and typically either because. Sometimes it's a category of case, so people have really strong opinions about categories of cases. As I do a lot of plaintiffs' work, and some people think that the legal system is a horrible place to resolve your problems. Mm. You should do it in other means, and that typically is not a good sign, for example, for a plaintiff's lawyer. So they have strong opinions about a particular category of case or a particular type of case. If those people concede or it's revealed that they can't be fair, the judge will pardon them from sitting on that jury.
Mm-hmm.
Other reasons that you may have that would be just categorically rule people out?
Typically it would be where they will state that I cannot be fair to this person because of that person's position, because of what it is they're alleged to do, because I think the police are always right. I mean, typically it's some sort of confession, concession, admission during the course of that selection process that they can't be fair. Mm-hmm. The other piece of the selection process is what we call strikes or peremptory challenges, which are each side, depending on the nature of the case, is given a certain amount of these strikes where you're allowed to take people off the jury without explanation, without any sort of offered rationale.
Mm. Okay. John Allen is with the University of Iowa College of Law. Also joining us, Sharon Greer, litigator for Cartwright Drucker Ryden in Marshalltown. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on selecting a jury. You have how many trials in which a jury was involved in your past?
I'm over 100 now, mm-hmm. I think. And what I would tell you is that we call it jury selection, but quite frankly, in all the educational materials and trainings that I've been through, it's really called jury deselection. So what we're trying to do, because you only have a short amount of time with these folks to get to know them and understand what their backgrounds are and their biases might be, what you're really trying to do is find those people that really will not be helpful to your side of the case and to strike those people to try to end up with people that might not have strong biases or strong feelings that will impact mm-hmm. your side.
What are the most typical ways in which jurors are struck from contention?
You mean some of the examples?
Yeah, most commonly that you see happening in the court.
I think people will a lot of times, and I think John discuss this a little bit too. People will just say, I just cannot pass judgment on this sort of thing. Or you represent a corporation, and I think corporations are terrible, and I can't sit here and be fair to your client.
Giving out your biases beforehand, just any indication that the impartiality would be problematic for this individual. What about those strikes that you have that John just mentioned that don't need a reason? What are the reasons that you have that you strike people and don't need to give a reason?
Well, sometimes I think, in jury selection, I've had people just totally, I can tell that with their questions that they're not going to be fair. They will say things and not even budge from an opinion, and you try to go the roundabout way to get them to maybe soften a little bit, and then you just know that they either, one, want to get off the jury, so they're saying things so they can get off, and mm-hmm. you have that sense, and you don't want those people because they're going to be angry at somebody, and it might be you.
So a juror who does not want to be on can inform him or herself about sort of techniques to get off the jury. That's perfectly allowed. We can't do anything about that, even though it's our civic duty to serve on a jury.
Right. And some judges are very good about lecturing them in the beginning about what a duty it is, and it's honorable, so that you minimize some of that behavior. But you see it happening in jury selection, and it's unfortunate. But it's good to know for your client's benefit that they're not wanting to be there.
Join our conversation. We discuss the American jury system with Sharon Greer, litigator from Marshalltown, also with John Whiston and John Allen of the University of Iowa College of Law. Have you served on a jury? What stood out for you about that experience? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or email. We're also on Facebook if you'd like to post a comment or a question there, relay an experience, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to Kevin in Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well.
So I guess my question is exactly why can't felons serve on a jury? And I'm asking this from personal experience. So I'm a convicted felon. I've served some time in prison. I served my time of probation. I've received my right to vote back, and I was actually elected to a public office here in Polk County. But sometime last year, I was asked to sit on a jury, and during the grand jury selection process, the judge proceeded to ask everybody, you know, have you been convicted of a felony? And I, you know, raised my hand, trying to be truthful, and they excused me from the court. They thanked me, you know, for my service, but they excused me from the court, and I kind of, you know, I felt insulted by not being able to participate, you know, in the judicial process. You know, even though I have this strike against me, I still feel like I'm worthy of being or capable of being impartial and helping in the judicial process. So,
Kevin, thank you very much for sharing your experience. Let's get some background on convicted felons. Who can tell us about that among our professors here? Are they stricken for their entire lives, or can they any way reclaim a ability? Do we know?
Boy, I think that's that restriction has existed for a long time. Whether with the restoration of civil rights that would include the right to sit on a jury, I don't know. I mean, the statute and I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is that it's one of the qualifications is that you not previously have been convicted of a felony. So I don't know if that's one of the civil rights that can be restored. It's an interesting question. I think it's been around for so long. I don't think either John or I or Sharon were present during the legislative discussions of those qualifications, but I think it's an excellent point.
Okay. Kevin, thank you very much for your call. I'm sorry we couldn't give you much more of an answer.
Okay, thank you.
Dana is joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Dana. Dana, sorry.
Hi.
Is it Dana or Dana?
Yeah. Dana.
Yes. Dana. Hi, Dana.
Hi. I was calling because when I was in middle school, my mom served on a jury, and I've always wanted to. I thought it was so fascinating, and I always vote thinking that would improve my chances of being called, but I've never been called, and I don't know anyone else who has. How often, what are a person's chances of being called for jury duty?
Good question, Dana, because it seems that some people are called to jury duty every few years. Others are not called over decades.
My wife has been called a half a dozen times. I never have. I think those people should buy lottery tickets because it appears to be all random. I can't explain it.
Nor I.
Okay.
All random. I would agree. All random.
Okay. Dana, thank you very much for your call from Iowa City. 1-866-780-9100. If you've served on a jury, what stood out for you about that experience? What questions do you have about our jury system? John Allen, you wanted to jump in there?
Well, I just want to, following up on what the caller said, there is a lot of people, I would say the majority of people, when you get called, I had the opportunity to be called in once, and I was told the trial would take about 5 days, and I, after recovering my breath and thinking about it, you know, I know what it's like for people to come in and to be told that they have to take a long time off. It's really an important service to the community. It's really our most basic democratic right that we have. And so I appreciate the caller's sentiment.
Okay, we're going to take a short break and come back and discuss the American jury system with John Allen and John Whiston of the University of Iowa College of Law. Also talking with Sharon Greer, a litigator for Cartwright, Drucker, and Ryden in Marshalltown. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about the development of juries, the rationale behind them. But also we want to talk about the George Zimmerman, the Trayvon Martin case that was recently in the news, high profile. If you have a question or a comment about the role the jury played in that trial, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about the American jury system this hour. Juries are used in a significant share of criminal, non-criminal cases in our country. Perhaps you've served on a jury. What was that experience like? Tell us what stood out for you, what questions you may have about the way a jury should work in theory and the way it works in practice. 1-866-780-9100. Our guests this hour, John Whiston, Herschel G. Langdon, Clinical Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. His colleague, John Allen, Clinical Professor and BOMA Fellow in Trial Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Also joining us by phone, Sharon Greer, Partner for Cartwright, Drucker, and Ryden in Marshalltown, also a litigator over 100 trials in her experience. And let's, lady and gentlemen, let's go to our first caller, Deb in Waterloo. Hi, welcome to our program.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. What have you got to discuss that concerns juries? Did you ever serve on a jury?
Yes, I've been on three times. I'm one of those people that gets picked every 2 years.
Okay.
And the last time I was actually chosen as the foreman, and it was a felon with a handgun. And I find that people, even though they think they are not going to be biased about it, it was mostly women. He was a young man. It was his third offense, and he was going to go to prison. And they had a really hard time looking at him and thinking about sending him to prison. But it was very black and white. We actually had the gun in a paper bag in the room where we discussed it. And they had a hard time coming to a decision.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you were not with them, those. Reading between the lines, are you saying that that there's a gender difference, you can say?
I think that in seeing the person in the courtroom with a suit on and his hair combed is a big difference than when he was in the vicinity of hundreds of college students and pulled it out of the back of his car.
Okay. Deb, thank you for sharing that experience. Sharon Greer, tell us about that. You heard a little bit about Deb in Waterloo and her experience being on several juries, this one in particular. Do you see as a litigator differences generally in whether it's a mostly male or mostly female jury?
I would tell you that generally not. It's more about perceptions that they bring into the courtroom from their life experiences. But I will tell you, and I might get in trouble for this a little bit, but a lot of times we find, and I've talked with a number of litigators about this, that sometimes women are harder on women than they are on the male party. And I think there's just something about that where they judge women a little more closely.
Mm-hmm. Deb talked about the relative youth of this person. You have jurors considering the impact on this person's life, and is that really to be part of the mix there to decide a narrow legal question and not decide what the penalty is or the impact on a young person's life? Is that right, Sharon?
That's right. The judge gives instructions of what the law involves, but oftentimes the emotion comes into the decision-making process. And as a good litigator, you weigh that as you're selecting your jury so that you can figure out who's had experiences where, for example, I tried an OWI the other day, and I want to know, have people had folks in their family that have been injured by a drunk driver? It will make a huge impact on how they feel in that jury room.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sharon Greer, thank you. Deb, for calling 1-866-780-9100 from Waterloo. Let's go to Marilyn, calling from Manchester. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello.
Have you been on a jury?
Yes, I have.
What was your experience like?
I thought it was wonderful. I think everybody should have to do it.
Why?
It's a very good experience. It gives you a real good idea of how the law really does work. I was on with a jury of people that were really good to work with. There was no arguments or anything. We all ended up agreeing on the same thing and stuff. But I really think it's a good experience for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So, Marilyn, it sounds like you may have come away from this experience with a more positive view of trial by jury than you had going into it.
Well, I just never had been on a jury, and I didn't know what to expect. Now, maybe if I'd have been on a different trial, it might have been different.
Right.
But the one I was on, it turned out really good. And
right. We all form perceptions, though, because of the media we consume, and we hear about trials all the time. But I guess that's what I mean, is it's more positive than you see portrayed or in media, news media.
Well, I think sometimes news media gets into stuff that they should stay out of until it's all settled.
Okay. Marilyn, thank you very much for your comment from Manchester, 1-866-780-9100. John Whiston, you wanted to jump in here.
I just wanted to second Marilyn's perception. I've always come away from a trial with a lot of respect for the jury. Even when I've lost the case, I have to, when I get back to the office, realize that they probably got it very close to right no matter what. And I think that is a reaction among most lawyers. I'd be interested in Sharon and John's perspective on that, that in Iowa we have 12-person juries for serious offenses, 8-person juries for civil cases, and 6-person juries for simple misdemeanors like public intoxication. But what I tell my students is that when you're doing a jury trial, you have 12 people watching everything that you do, and that they're not going to miss something. Well, you know, 10 of them might miss it, but 2 of them won't. And I think a jury of 12 people is really smart, and odds are that they're going to get it right. And there's a lot of social science to that effect, too.
John Allen.
So every good trial lawyer should believe in how smart juries are. You have to show respect for the group that's going to make a decision. And John's a good trial lawyer. I've watched him work. So I know he's going to say that, and I know Sharon's going to say that. Let me say, I do think that there are some species of decisions that are difficult. So I, for example, have tried cases involving discrimination based on race or ethnicity. Because of the way our juries are composed here, rarely would you have a minority member on a jury on an Iowa jury. It's actually a rare experience.
Why would that be?
Well, it's drawn from the population. So
we have few minorities in this state to
few
begin with.
Minorities in this state, and unfortunately, let me just say this: that the number of minorities that come in the veneer, the group that initially comes in, tends to be somewhat underrepresented compared to that in the general population. It's a long story to sort of get there. But the point I want to make here is that there might be some decisions where the jury's members' experience might be radically different than the experience of one of the participants in the trial. So I do think there are some species of cases where my confidence level goes down a little bit. But I probably say that every time I lose a case, by the way.
Before we have some comments to end the hour on the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case, Sharon Greer, after more than 100 cases, trials, do you have more or less confidence in the jury system?
I have great confidence in the system, and I also do a questionnaire that I send out after we're done, after I get permission from the judge, and it's anonymous. And they can send it back to me without identifying which juror they are. And they write very honest information back and oftentimes pick out things about the trial that amazes me. And I have great faith in the system based upon what they do as a collective group and also what they write me later on.
So it's almost like a classroom experience, and you're a teacher trying to gather feedback after a semester and in order to hone your skills.
I learn every time.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case, the state of Florida v. George Zimmerman, a criminal prosecution of George Zimmerman on a charge of second-degree murder stemming from the shooting of Trayvon Martin in February of 2012. In support of the charges, the state filed an affidavit of probable cause stating that Zimmerman profiled and confronted Martin, shot him to death while Martin was committing no crimes. Zimmerman said he shot Martin in self-defense. After 16 hours of deliberations, the 6-person jury rendered a not guilty verdict on all counts. Let me turn to you first, John Allen. Why a 6-person jury?
That's what Florida has chosen to have as the as the jury size. I think, and I think we all probably have some thoughts about what happens with 6-person juries, which is that it's less of a cross section of the community. But the Supreme Court has held that that's the constitutional minimum For this type of case. And
in Iowa, is that allowed, a six-person
no,
jury?
No, not for that type of controversy. We would have a 12-person jury for charges that for any felony charge.
John Whiston, your thoughts on the makeup of the jury in this case?
Well, Florida is the only state in the country that has a six-person jury where the charge carries with it the potential sentence of life imprisonment. And so that was a case that was decided by the United States Supreme Court in 1970 based on some really flawed social science. I've seen that there have been suggestions that the Supreme Court should go back and review this because you get six people, they miss stuff. And the social science is quite clear that they make mistakes, particularly with this jury where it appears that there was at least one juror that was troublesome. And that, I think, is going to mess with the decision-making process in so many ways.
Sharon Greer, as a prosecutor, through a prosecutor's eyes, how did you see this trial and the jury's role in it?
Well, it's interesting because I think everyone needs to go back to what a jury service involves, and that is your information is presented in that time frame. You only get to see that information. The judge gives you the law, and you only consider the law that the judge gives you. And so to be critical of this panel is difficult because they do not get everything that the rest of us get from the media and all the different analysis that we get. And they have a very defined amount of information, and they make that decision. And so I'm not as critical because I was not there in their chair and saw exactly what they saw and got the law that they had to interpret.
We have an email from Alonia. She writes, I was on a jury last year, lasted about a week, and enjoyed it senselessly. I thought it was fascinating, and even though the other members of the jury and I were very different, we worked together very well, another positive experience about being in a jury. But let's talk about the Trayvon Martin case, because in that we had a couple of interviews done with jurors post-verdict. Here's a clip from one of them, interviewed by ABC's Good Morning America, Robin Roberts, about a week and a half after that verdict. The juror B-29, also known as Maddie, presumably a juror who wanted to convict Zimmerman of second-degree murder, but felt that because of the way the law was written, it was unable to do so. Here's Maddie, the juror, discussing how how her participation in the jury has affected her.
I feel that I was forcibly included in Trayvon Martin's death. I carry him on my back. I'm hurting as much as Trayvon Martin's mom is.
So when you do those post-trial questionnaires, Sharon Greer, do you see how many jurors do you see really going through the pain that we hear from juror 29, B-29?
I'm not trying cases that involve death in terms of a criminal death, but in terms of injuries and those sorts of things. A lot of times people do have a lot of difficulty because the decision they made doesn't give the plaintiff, because a lot of times I'm on the defense of those types of cases, doesn't give the plaintiff recovery, but they feel like the law is such that they can't. And so sometimes they do have a lot of post-decision regret about what has happened. But they do feel bound by, and I think for the most part feel like they've done their duty, but they just feel like they could not do what they maybe would have loved to have done because of the bounds of the law.
John Whiston.
I think this is one of the things that Sharon hit upon, and that is that especially in a criminal case, we have very strict rules about what evidence can be brought in. We have a very elaborate developed law that they're going to be instructed on. And I think that there were so many other considerations that were at work in the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case, the gun rights piece, the racial profiling piece, that having so many limitations on what the jury can hear and what the options are legally for them to come to a decision, it's not a very good way to conduct a discussion about these really important public policy decisions. And so I don't know that we should really take all that much away from it.
Okay. Of course, one of the hallmarks of this case was that after the verdict, President Obama said that Trayvon Martin could have been me, saying the black community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and history that doesn't go away. Here's more of what the president had to say July 19th, discussing the African community, American community's reaction to this not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman murder trial.
There are very, very few African American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And you know, I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African American community interprets what happened one night in Florida.
President Obama on the not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman murder trial. It's as Sharon, you brought out, the jury is really only is sequestered. Is only answering one legal question here, but surrounding it, obviously, in this case, a huge discussion of our culture, John Allen.
So I think a lot of people were really discouraged by that verdict, that it seemed to deny this reality that many people saw, that this kid was profiled and because of his race. I happen to agree with John Whiston's observation that a trial having to do with criminal charges is not always the best forum for airing these important social issues. I know the president's comments caused some level of controversy, but if we're going to take something from this experience, it should be to begin a serious discussion about race in our culture and what that experience might be to be a teenage African American kid in our culture. So I actually think the president started an important conversation, one that is appropriate for the kinds of fora here, for example, and sitting around coffee or wherever it happens to be, an important discussion that we begin to understand each other. The trial may not itself, for the reasons that both Sharon and John have described, be the best place. Certainly the jurors don't appear to have had that sort of penetrating discussion along this issue, and it may be that the facts and circumstances and the laws presented really didn't afford that opportunity for them to grapple with these broader societal issues.
Sharon Greer, as we end the hour, did you have a takeaway from the Trayvon Martin case?
Just the same as these other gentlemen have discussed, and to keep in mind that, you know, their mission was not to solve our social issues. Theirs was to determine one case based on one set of facts that was presented to them in a certain way. And so to not take so much from that, but to look forward and analyze how these issues do impact our society.
Mm-hmm. Sharon Greer, I wonder if we can end this hour by having you look back at when you had your first trial that involved a jury. I believe in the 1980s, you have over 100 trials since then as a litigator. When you think back to that first trial, let's say you yourself are standing there, you're able to talk to yourself in an earlier form. What would you tell that person, your earlier version of yourself, as a lesson learned or lessons learned? Remember this about juries that I had to learn the hard way, perhaps.
I would always say, and I've talked to a lot of young attorneys about this, is to be yourself and have your own style. And remember that a lot of times these jurors are as nervous as you are, and it's all about having a great conversation where they're talking so you can learn about them. And once they trust you in jury selection, then it carries throughout the trial, and you can actually get the best result that you can because you have formed this relationship.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like creating you as a believable storyteller, a believable narrator, so creativity in here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the fun part of what we do.
Okay. Your job, though, is stressful sometimes, I imagine.
It's very stressful, but it's also very rewarding. And I can tell you example where after a trial is over, my clients have sent wonderful flowers and chocolates and those sort of things because they've thought it was going to be a terrible experience. And I always tell my clients, when we get done, you're going to say, that was not so bad, and I actually enjoyed that experience. And frankly, they do. It's fun.
Okay. Sharon Greer, partner for Cartwright, Drucker, and Dryden in Marshalltown. John Allen and John Whiston of the University of Iowa College of Law, thank you as well for coming into our studio and lending us your expertise. Thank you both.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon.
Bye, Sharon.
Bye-bye.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of this program available at our website. Just go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Remember, Politics Wednesday tomorrow. Hope you'll tune in.